Bay Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together? Is my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. And go.
Welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. Should have Matt burning a little bit. Power was out and all these incredible storms that keep coming through Chicago here. This is not like your lazy rain on the weekends. Every one of these things that comes through now is somewhat of an event. Trees down, all kinds of stuff. There's a house on 143rd, Jimmy. The tree is still in the house after a week.
Hey there, Chief.
How are you? We also have Mr. John Lee. How are you?
Yeah, good. I got to get off at 6:30 here. But you know, speaking about trees, I saw on Norwood, you remember that street where I have a house?
Yeah.
And huge, I mean, it's got to be a foot and a half at least, branch came down and it destroyed two cars. I mean, it crushed them. It was horrific.
That happened to your buddy Todd's car in front of my place when he lived there. Not much coming back from that.
No, not much coming back from that.
Especially if you have like a unibody and you're really screwed. Hey, by the way, S&P futures up 5, NASDAQ futures up 83. As we keep creeping up here, as we have money seemingly coming in the system from all sides. But anyway, I want to ask you, John, we talked with Carl Friday, we talked about the labor report, and he was mentioning that Kroger is laying off most or all of their IT department and just setting up shop over in India. And How does that work? I mean, I'm not a big fan of tariffs, but there are no tariffs on services, right? Or are there?
Not to my knowledge, because those are internal. You know, it's pretty hard to figure. I mean, you're not shipping something physical over.
Well, you are shipping something.
So but you're certainly shipping, services over. I mean, knowledge capital. So, I mean, that's it. I mean, God, I spend a lot of time at the consulting firm I was with.
That's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, that's exactly what we would do. I mean, and let's be honest, it was a cost arbitrage is what it was.
All right, well, let's kind of take it from the top here, if you don't mind. I know I'm kind of jumping you on this, but you're the guy who knows more about this. If a guy like you, say, goes over to India to work, okay, you're still getting paid from here, you're paying taxes there, and if you're not paying enough, I guess you're paying here too. If your residence is here, what if there's somebody has a 20 person firm in India, and you just buy the time of the people in that firm? You say, okay, I'll give you guys $80 an hour for your, or $40 an hour, whatever the hell it is, for your 10 people. You're going to put on my stuff. No, you're not going to pay any. What happens? You're not paying any Social Security. You're not paying any unemployment. You're just paying 50 bucks. I'm just paying $50 an hour per.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, the end of the month, you send the check, basically, or wire the money, whatever the hell you do, right? And,
yeah.
And then there's nothing else in there. There's no, you're just buying a service. It's like if you're buying widgets, although they're not widgets. They're people. With the widgets, you have to pay a tariff if there is a tariff. But people, you don't. Is that the truth? You just send
no,
a check.
I don't, I'm not aware of. I mean, when we would outsource, when we were doing outsourcing, I don't remember tariffs being any any issue.
I don't know. Yeah, well, they weren't really an issue on goods until Trump decides they're to be all end all. But by and large, if there are going to be tariffs, they're not on services, which is a little weird.
I just looked it up here, but there's no enacted federal tax specifically targeting general outsourcing. And, I mean, you know, I think people realize this, but I am positive 70% of the time you call your bank or any other organization, the customer support you're talking to, you know, a very large office tower in the Philippines. And, I mean, they have hundreds of thousands of people working in these. But no, there is none. There is now. There is a bill that's called the Quality and International Relocation of Employment Hire Act, a 25% excise tax on outsourcing payments made by U.S. companies.
But it's
I'm not sure that's a bad idea. I don't, you know, of course, it could also have some horrible, you know, some other effects.
Well, no man can do one thing, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, the other, you know, in the IT industry, it's just rife with people that get to train their replacement.
Right, just to summarize, they send you to London. They're still paying you. While you're in London, I assume they're still paying Social Security and unemployment tax. But
if I'm a U.S. employee, then absolutely. And I also, depending on the amount of time, the length of time in London, I'll be paying, British taxes as well.
Well, you don't pay both.
My income went up by a factor of 3 to 4 just on tax equalization.
Okay, but if the rate, say your rate here is 40 and the rate in Timbuktu is 30 and you paid a 30 there, you're only paying 10 here, right?
The way it works is if you go over for 2 months, then there's no tax issues. You go over for 9 months, then you're going to have tax issues. And you'll be taxed in both places. You're going to be taxed in the UK. And so, I mean, companies have to have these pretty large organizations just to do this.
Okay, now, again, this isn't it?
Now,
isn't
let me just finish one thing here. So if I go to London and I become a London employee, I think it's the first $125,000 of what I earn is not taxed here. But the $126,000 is taxes if you were, at the same rate there. But so it does kick in. So you do have a foreign income exclusion rule there.
Well, because, I mean, a corporation, if you're supposed to pay, say, 25% here, and you pay 10% somewhere else, you get to credit that against your 25. So you're saying a person doesn't get the same?
No, absolutely not.
Isn't that special?
We are one of three countries. You know, they call it the axis of taxation. Us, North Korea, and Vietnam. Because, you know, most countries do not tax overseas wages. Most countries don't. So if I was in Australia or Singapore, and if I was a Singaporean citizen and I work in London, my London income is not taxed in Singapore. Whereas as an American, my income will be taxed. But there is a foreign income exclusion.
All right.
Exclusion.
Well, it seems like if somebody just decides to go ahead and do that, I got a little bit of a problem with it because obviously they're saving on hospitalization, they're saving on FICA, and they're saving on unemployment, right? But if they hire somebody over in India, say, instead of somebody here.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's not so.
And, hot. I'm going to tell you, the pressure to do that, this goes back a couple of years. I mean, it was pretty intense on companies. You are really, really pressured by investors and management to outsource as much as, you know, the game with you would play what most companies do, like when I was with DXC or Kyndryl, is you'll have one or two I'm exaggerating here. You know, if you have an if you've had to outsource 1,000 people, you'll have maybe 50 here locally. And part of this whole H-1B-1 visa issue is that they are they're bringing people over to help run these outsource after we've gotten rid of the job. So that's really one of the political backlashes here too.
Well, it seems to me that you know, what you sort of a minor theme of the show is we talk about rules and crime and punishment and so forth, which never happens, it appears. And from my experience on the trading floor, you can't get to the situation, you can't let anything get anywhere to where if you're not cheating, you're not trying. If all of a sudden the only way to get ahead is to be a crook. So if you let one, two, or three companies do this, and their effective IT stuff is $50. Well, I doubt if it's equivalent. I mean, I don't think the people there are as good, but I doubt if it's equivalent. But if you're paying $100 here and they're paying $50 there, it's pretty hard for you to compete against somebody. Now, the issue comes down to, you know, I had, my phone company is Consumer Cellular now. I don't remember the name of the guys that were before, but it was one of those off brand companies that piled into one of the other ones. There's a bunch of them, and their big shtick was if you called somebody, called them, you got somebody here, and you got somebody who could talk to you. And all of a sudden, one day I called and I said, I wanted another line, and I couldn't buy one from this person. I'm like, by the way, where the hell are you? I don't know if they said Philippines or India or someplace. I'm like, you know, forget it. And I switched companies. But it reaches a point where when you have and the part that really bothers the living bejesus out of me here is the only people, well, I won't say the only people, but the people that can pull that off the best are monopolies, because they don't care about competition, right? They don't care if you treat you like dog manure on the phone, because you got nowhere else to go. So if you call Commonwealth Edison, and they I'm not sure they do, but if they offsource to God knows where, what exactly are you going to do about it, right? If you can't understand a person or anything like that, can you imagine somebody who's, you know, I won't pick on anybody. Imagine somebody who's like Hispanic, even if they know English and it's their second language, trying to talk to these people about their electric bill or anything else.
Yeah.
I can't even. It's hard enough for me, and I'm supposed to be an educated guy. You can't break one against the other, because if it was really competitive, the minute somebody would do that, they'd slam the phone down. Oh, I got a good one for you yesterday. Audrey has this. By the way, later in the show, just so everybody knows, we're going to have Dr. Blade, Dr. Mark Johnson, psychologist, calling in, our psychologist of the show and roommate of mine from college and best friend, calling in because the ladies are off. The poor poodle is getting doggy ACL surgery today. Yeah, and so Audrey's taking her, and Nancy, of course, is going with, because Audrey's kind of a mess about it. But she's such a sweet dog. I mean, she hurt herself in the dog park, and it's like a half tear, so they're going to do some kind of surgery today and hope she's all right. It's a six-week recovery. She's got to go to rehab, the pooch. Got to go to the doggy swimming pool. Anyway, Dr. Blade is going to be calling in. But this lady friend of hers, she sold her a place and actually two places, and she's 83 years old. She is sharp as a tack, goes to yoga and swimming and everything all the time. Just absolutely terrific lady. She was married to this, I met him once, big, huge black guy. I'm still probably 6'2". And he towers over me. It turns out he played ball for the Pistons way back in the day, like way back in the day. And then he was a coach. And he was an author and wrote some really good books. Absolutely terrific guy. Anyway, she buys a new fridge from Home Depot. So the fridge gets to her place, and of course it doesn't work, right? Inside's all steaming up, doesn't get cold. She just has the thing delivered like on Friday or Thursday. So she goes over to Audrey, so Audrey says, I'll help you out. So she goes online, she gets the Home Depot number. Where do you suppose they pick up the phone?
Philippines or India.
No, Baton Rouge.
Okay, all right.
And so she says, well, you know, my friend here bought this fridge and the damn thing doesn't work. Oh, she had it more than like 48 hours? Well, what does that got to do with anything? Well, then we have to like talk about warning. What do you... The thing doesn't work. It didn't work from the day it sat there. It got there. I mean, what's so hard about going and giving her another fridge, for God's sake? Yet, Home Depot's becoming pretty much a monopoly. They would say no, but they compete with what? Two other people? Maybe there's some fringe people along the side.
Yeah, they compete with Menards. Well, in our area, they compete with Menards, and that's it.
Well, Lowe's, I think, is countrywide, right? Pretty much.
Yeah, I don't think it has. Yeah, it is. Now, I will say I've got a story that's completely, you know, they delivered, you know, I replaced all the sinks in the house downtown, and one of the sinks that came in was broken. The Kohler sink was broken. And so, you know, they took it back, and they gave me a credit. They gave me a new sink, and they gave me a credit. I think they may have made a mistake. So I had somewhat of the opposite experience, but that is pretty bizarre.
Yeah.
After 2 days,
yeah,
they go. Now that's really, yeah.
Well, so
that's pretty.
So she's going to take herself over to the only way Audrey could get the phone number to the local Home Depot was through Yelp. It wasn't even on their site.
Really?
Yeah. So they call and she's going to go over there today and say, "Hey, my fridge doesn't work." But I mean, so it's all this stuff is kind of tied together, John. I mean, if you were,
okay, I see where you were going. I mean,
if you're in a very,
they don't have to compete, then they don't.
Yeah, if you're in a very competitive, I mean, you can call AT&T and they put you through the ringer. Where are you going to go? I guess you could go to Verizon and they put you through the ringer, right? I mean, you can't even get anybody to talk to you. And if you
let me tell you, you go to some of the banks, and I shall not say it, but the first name of the bank is Citi.
Yeah,
it is. They have purposely, cut back, so it is impossible to talk to a real person on the phone.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They don't want you to.
Yeah, and it is just horrendous. And the credit card is better, the credit card support line, but the actual standard checking and, you know, in basically, when I was reading about this, it's all done on purpose because, you know, they just want high net worth people, and that's it, especially overseas. But no, it is. Some of the banks are horrible to deal with,
and they're so big. You're not supposed to have, what's the number, Jimmy? What's the number? You're not supposed to have more than 10% of all the deposits in the country. Yet there's two or three of them that are over 10%. Have been for a while. We don't go after anything. I mean, we're going to talk when Dr. Mark comes.
Go ahead.
I don't know who that is, but you wonder, there isn't a law around that people seem to be concerned about unless somebody's pointing it right at you, you know, which is really, you know, somewhat bizarre. We talk about antitrust all the time, and now they're, you know, Jan, we're getting up there a little bit. You're watching what the younger people seem to believe, and it was really interesting that Larissa was talking about how the younger people in a lot of their economics classes are absolutely pro, like, socialism and communism. Not that they even know what it is, but they just think whatever we got right now is just really sucks. Only a few people make all the dough. They own everything else. They own everything. They sense a plutocracy, even though they probably don't even know what the term means, which is interesting. You'd think you'd figure out what the term means before you'd. But, you know, I'm not. It's pretty interesting. And one of our friends the other day said that his daughter, and she's in school, and everybody in the schools, not everybody, in her opinion, which, you know, again, this Netanyahu has sent people's view of Jewish people back 40 years.
Absolutely. But, you know, Tom, there's a cycle here. And, yeah. I mean, I've mentioned this several times, but, you know, because I love history, especially 1850s up to, you know, into right after the war, World War II. And, you know, let's not forget with the Prairie, what were they called? The Prairie Radicals.
Yeah.
I mean, we have had a, especially after, you know, the turn of the century, especially after World War One, we had a huge amount of socialist, and the Communist Party was, you know, within the intelligentsia was very powerful. I mean, it was very strong, not powerful, but it's very strong. And that's what led to the Cambridge Five, you know, because they saw what the system was doing, the system. And they said in the UK specifically, or even in Europe, you said, okay, the existing system just sent us, killed an entire generation of young men. And, you know, and we had the same thing. This, you know, when you had all of the, what was the novel built that was written about the slaughterhouses here in Chicago by Theodore Dreiser?
The jungle. And so, it wasn't Theodore Dreiser, somebody else.
We had a socialist movement here.
Lewis Sinclair.
In communist movement here. I mean, the first half of the century was very prevalent. One of the guys, and he was a very famous labor organizer, he was actually the charge of the steel workers.
Okay.
But anyways, he was, I read this quotation. He said to a bunch of steel workers, he says, "You guys are making rifle barrels and they're pointed right back at you." I mean, so this is, I mean, these are these prairie radicals were very strong.
Well, the only
socialist movements. Of course, they went too long out of the country.
The only thing we tried last week, I tried to have a show, and I don't know if it bombed or what it did, but I tried to have a show regarding when people don't like the current situation, and you're not, I use the term, not all that educated. You know, they're smart people, they're not dummies. When I say you don't, nobody cares about what they actually say and whether or not it makes, and on last, I don't know what day it was, I tried to have a show regarding that. And you and I talked about it on Tuesday night. I mean, the people who call themselves socialists right now, what they really mean is they're against what we have. And, I mean, the definition of a socialist, which you and I were talking about last week, socialist is comes down to property rights, that they want, that the government or the commune owns all the property. Well, none of these people that are running as socialists want to give up their business to the government. They're anti-current, but they don't, there's not another name for it, so they land into the socialist camp or the communist camp, even though they're really not socialists, because the only place I've ever seen was a total socialist in my collective lifetime is a kibbutz. I mean, you go to Finland, I was there for a wedding. Well, the guy was driving me around. He owned an auto repair shop. The country didn't own it. He did. So in terms of paying more taxes and everybody going to school for free, that's something. But it's not socialism. It's the amount of who owns all the property. For somebody to call them, I mean, if you want. Everybody, I listened to Bernie Sanders just thinking, why do I listen to that guy? He was on Face the Nation. And he was ranting and raving about Medicare for all. Now, what does he mean? Does he mean everybody gets Medicare benefits? Does he mean everybody gets the Medicare price? Because the Medicare price is way less than anybody else's price, which is kind of bizarre. Now, should everybody get that price? Maybe, probably. That doesn't mean, you know, I mean, how has the price of medicine totally outstripped the ability of anybody to pay for it? And if you don't deal with cost, I mean, Bernie really needs a calculator. If you don't deal with, if the cost of medicine in this country, which most people, not, you know, a lot of people don't even get, is 21% of the economy, just having somebody else pay for it doesn't solve the problem.
So, you know, this is a big issue. I mean, this is an issue I've thought about, and you guys are probably, you know, you're better at numbers than I am. If we look at how much we spend in healthcare, and we look at other developed countries, they have good healthcare systems. From what I remember reading, it's 5 points difference. I mean, if we're spending 21%, other countries are spending 15 or 16.
Maybe less.
And I think it is less. And I am really surprised that nobody has said, if we were to fix the cost basis of this, the impact in the economy. I mean, Tom, Jimmy, aren't you then just freeing up that 5% to be spent on other productive?
You are, but you're laying off half the administration in Northwestern, which would probably be a good thing.
But I mean, am I wrong here? I mean,
no, you're not.
Wouldn't that be the biggest economic boost you could ever have?
Well, the one lesson when it comes to numbers, if anybody who listens to the show can take from me, and I don't know where I learned this, always take it down to the lowest level. When you identify, things that of cost, instead of having this broad idea and face the nation of yelling about Medicare, this, that, take it down to John Lee walks into the drugstore and buys a pill. Now, is the pill on patent? What does it cost them to come up with the pill? Now, if it costs them $2 and you're paying 10, there's a problem there. And if doesn't matter who we get to pay the 8, it's somebody is holding the short end. You know, we can force government to pay for it. We can pay for it. We can do something. The fact is, the margin is too much. If the pill was 4 and they only made 100% on it, guess what? We wouldn't have the problem, I don't think. I mean, you walk into an emergency room, and if you have a kid, he cuts his finger. I haven't been in an emergency room lately, but Jimmy has had a couple friends that have. Jimmy, what's the minimum emergency room visit? $10,000?
Easy.
For nothing.
Oh, there's lots of things.
You have to be admitted. Yeah.
You have to have a first nurse to look at you, then the emergency room doctor. If they order any blood work or anything like that, x-rays, then they get a piece of it. And then you finally get discharged by another doctor. So it's layered.
Well, I read this thing once about... Good. This is a while ago. So
you know what, gentlemen, I got to get going here. I apologize. All right. Talk to you later.
Do we have Mr. Flanagan? Okay.
You do. Good morning,
all. All right, bud.
Hey, John. Good.
John,
I miss you.
I miss you too, John.
All right.
We're talking about somebody's cause. I was listening to, I don't know why yesterday, because I was up early and did a bunch of stuff. I'm listening to Face the Nation. At first, I was saddled with Bernie Sanders, which is always enough to mess up your morning. Then there was this guy afterward. And I don't think, how can I say this? I don't think the dude was as articulate, maybe, as I could be. But he was literally fighting with Margaret Brennan about the COVID situation, which we sort of do here. And he was talking about, evidently it was about the Fauci hearings. And the guy was, and she's correct in one sense. And he was not very good at articulating what he was talking about, which wasn't so good, but he was talking about the bad decisions that were made, the really horrible decisions. But being, somewhat of a Trumper, he was trying to pin those decisions totally on Biden. And I think most of us know it was a blend of incompetency between Trump and Biden. Maybe, a lot of the mask stuff and everything probably was Biden, but basically Fauci worked for both of them. And he was talking about how it really was important to get to the bottom of some of these decisions. Like I said, he wasn't all that articulate. And she was all over that it was just a political witch hunt, blah, blah, blah. And I don't think that's true, to be honest with you. I don't think she was right about that. I mean, I don't care if this is the one that you do something with. One of these days, we have to grab something. You know, who's making money in Iran, whether it's a COVID situation. We've got to drive one to ground, don't we? So it just doesn't keep happening over and over and over again. I mean, there were some really bad decisions on COVID that cost people. You know, like the guy was saying, they had the stuff about the antibodies, which I've said 100 times. He goes, the antibodies, your own antibodies were good enough. They shouldn't have made those people get a shot. And they did. And he goes, people lost jobs when they had antibodies, couldn't get it again, at least for a while, and were forced to get shots. He goes, those were crazy sort of decisions. And if there was money behind it, we got to find out about it. And she's like, all right, so all you are is, pushing people against Biden and, for Trump. And I don't know if he was doing that or not, but the fact is, I think the truth here kind of tattoos both sides, doesn't it? If we ever found it.
Fauci muscled his way in at the beginning while Trump was president. And
you know, he muscled his way in when Reagan was president.
I mean, but in the COVID thing, I mean, he was the point person, and you know, I would say maybe as it seemed intelligent at the time, if this person is a health expert and is supposed to know all this or has some kind of important viewpoint to lend to the situation, then you give him a platform, and he took it in spades, and Dr. Birx with him. And daily, multiple times daily, you ended up being assaulted by these people, and in the the moment when everybody's sort of panicked by what the heck's going on here, people didn't notice really how much the ground was shifting underneath these healthcare professionals, and you had all the blather coming at you, too much misinformation at once, and then you had the local ones too. Remember the county health department ads, all of the the really creepy, I think, public service announcements with all these physicians, and their names were always given, and they were in the Cook County health system, and trust us. About my life? No, I don't think so.
Well, that's what he was sort of talking about. He goes, and I know this because my doctor got one of these. They give everybody they sent people letters saying if you don't agree with the system, you're going to be like, what's the medical equivalent of being disbarred? You're going to be tossed out. And she got a letter from the state of Illinois saying if she spoke out against the shots, that she was going to be, her license going to get pulled. Well, there's a way to stop, stop stuff. Hey, but we've talked about that enough. What about the market here, guys? And what about the Cubs and Sox? I mean, we haven't had this kind of a dual baseball excitement here. Have we ever had it where both teams were good? I mean, I'm sure somewhere looking back, we both had two good teams, but I think they might both be playoff bound here. It's fun watching the Sox. It's fun watching the Cubs. I mean, their hitting can be frustrating, but have you ever seen a team as good on defense, Jimmy? Very bizarre. Hey, I always got to throw in a baseball trivia on Monday. I don't know why I'm doing it today, but there was an article. Quora said, "What if there was rumors of a trade at the time? What if they would have made a trade straight up, Joe DiMaggio for Ted Williams? What do you think, Jimmy? You always got a baseball opinion."
On that one, no, I don't. I mean, it depends on what time period we're talking about. Otherwise, it's a pretty straight-up trade. Two great hitters.
Well, the guy in Quora made a pretty serious attempt to say that if you switched ballparks, you'd have a totally different stat line for DiMaggio. Because he was a big power hitter to the left side. In Yankee Stadium, left center field was, 430 feet?
Something like that, yes.
That he actually hit, unlike just about any big star, this probably happened for people in Pittsburgh, too, because the park was so big. He hit way more home runs on the road than he did at home. That if he were to turn that around and added the amount that he got on the road at home, he'd have been, in the 400 home run range type of thing. It would have been a major difference kind of in his stats, and maybe Ted Williams as well, because the porch in Yankee Stadium on the left field side is so much shorter than it was at Fenway. So it was a pretty interesting article, just saying. It had nothing to do with the players themselves. It just had to do with where they played.
Yeah, those stats can be parsed a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Back when ballparks were, I think, quirkier maybe than they are now, at least generally, even though the modern ones I've been in, don't strike me as being unusual in their configuration, really. I mean, maybe in their amenities and their complexity, but not in the layout.
Well, there's still some. The one in Phoenix is they have some that are different. The one that was huge was at Forbes Field. The one in Pittsburgh before that one, because that thing was 400 feet down the line or something. So yeah, it was
and asymmetrical ones like Fenway.
Yeah, they're all. But anyway, we have all this news coming out this week. We got the CPI coming out. What do you make the Bodias in regards to what do you make in terms of the labor numbers on Friday? And I just find it very difficult to trade on the bad news is good news kind of stuff. But the number was horrible. And Carl started talking about how everybody at Kroger is getting laid off because they're moving everybody to India. And we're talking with John Lee this morning. There's no cost to that. I'm no fan of tariffs, but I don't see why you would have a tariff on, if you were going to have one, why you would have a tariff on something that's manufactured and not on a service. I mean, I'm not a tariff guy, but if you're going to do it, why not? You know, why not both of them, type of thing. Anyway, so what were your comments on the Friday stuff?
Well, I think these numbers are going to be revised downward, next month too. I think I just don't see job creation as a priority, or even a reality, given the AI push and. Just the dislocations in population, Tom. I mean, I think that we don't really understand how this has turned into some kind of cultural, event where you've got states hemorrhaging people and other states, booming by comparison. Maybe they're not doing that great in the long run either. But I there's such uncertainty and lack of commitment to a place, because you've sort of figured out this is not a growth spot to be in. This is a state that doesn't know how to, run a budget. It doesn't know how to keep its people safe or secure, or to not tax them into oblivion. So let me go somewhere else where the grass is greener, and maybe in the 30s in the Dust Bowl there was something like that. Of course, that was more drastic. More sudden, and had its own kind of culture against the backdrop of the Depression that's kind of hard to compare to today. But I just feel like there's no anchor in any of this where people can confidently plan for the next 2-5 years of their life or their family's life. Everything seems to be up in the air, and there's nothing really to hold people to a lot of these places that I just think are sinking ships. I mean, I put Illinois in this category too. So that, but what that does to job numbers, I can't really say, other than that I know it has a huge impact on where job growth, if there is going to be any, is going to happen. So any benefit is going to be pretty unequal. The statistics, whatever they may be, don't tell you what's really going on in state A versus state B, unless you really want to dig in. And I don't have the skill to do that or the time, but I do think that this is something we're not looking at or thinking about. And in the long run, we've got states that are going to be so behind the curve, and states that'll be so whacked out and booming like mad that they're going to have crashes at some point too. Some natural disaster, an earthquake, a series of storms. But this doesn't take a whole lot to disrupt any state's economy if you get hit the wrong way. And we're just kind of, we have nothing really we can cling to that's going to hold us through a job market that's certainly tough, but you add all these other things to it, and it's an impossible job market for a lot of people in certain age groups and certain genders. There's no reason to stick around in the place you've been living in or born in or where your family's lived in and hope that it gets better, because it's not going to. So,
well, at some point, when you see the demise of Chicago and the factories leaving, we got a perfect example with this one. And, I'm not going to accuse you of this, and I have no idea who the hell the mayor is in Cincinnati, nor do I really care. But I guess I do care. But now Kroger leaves. Now, if it's 5,000 jobs, 8,000 jobs, or they don't leave, they send these people out of there. All of a sudden, there's a hole in the Cincinnati budget of some kind. So if they have to raise taxes elsewhere to make up for it, which they probably will, and all of a sudden you got a bunch of people that are on unemployment, or at least for a while, it's hard to turn around and say, look at it, look at that damn, you know, Democratic mayor or Republican mayor, wherever he happens to be. I mean, the hole in Chicago was, a lot of it was caused by, if you go way back, goes back to incredible screws up in the pension laws. When you had pensions for people, if somebody else bought the company, you essentially got to steal the overvalued pension fund. Nobody remembers that. Nobody cares. And yet when you see these vast empty lots in south side of Chicago where places used to be, and you go, God, it must have been this Democratic mayor. No, it wasn't. It had to do with Pullman got taken over so they could raid the pension fund. And the same thing happened to Ream. Same thing happened to all. Same thing happened to the steel companies. They had all this money in the pension fund, and years later, all the money was gone, and all these, and the place was vacant. And oh, by the way, these people are getting stiffed, and they're on the government pension at half of what they were supposed to get. And everybody blames it on the mayor. Well, it's not the mayor. You know, I mean, somewhere along the line, people in quote business have been allowed to do this, John. And why were they? Jimmy, talk for a second.
Okay, I'll talk. There's, I don't know about, you know, the businesses and who and what. And all I know is that when they go to outsourcing, as we've done before, earlier on the show, is it's usually a decision. And you don't know if there are actually people in Cincinnati. A lot of places, their IT people are all over the country now. They're not necessarily in one area anymore. My former job, most of our IT people are actually located in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And we do outsource that too. So it's not a easiest thing. I knew it, you know, with the banks. It was easy. Why pay someone $25 here when I could pay them $5 somewhere else?
Well, but then it comes down is, are they as good? Are they, if they're as third as good, you're paying them half, you know, a quarter as much, then I guess it's okay. Then it comes down to money, right? But you also got to be, I mean, what are you getting out of these people?
Well, like you said, I mean, these are the big banks. So where else are you going to go?
It all ties in with the anti-competitive stuff, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. You know, I'll give my example this weekend. My brother wanted to get a phone, and we used T-Mobile. T-Mobile, you can't buy a phone at the store anymore. You have to go through the app.
Really?
Yes. And so, you know, excuse me, that was a rigmarole, and we finally got it that you could. T-Mobile, the people at the apps, aren't there for customer service. They're there to sell you stuff. That's it.
Well, I know if you go to the T-Mobile store and you bought it online, they don't service you. It's like a different group.
Exactly. Yeah. The only thing that they'll do is you can order the phone to pick it up.
Yeah, but they're not going to help you.
That's exactly correct. They will not. They don't set up the phones anymore unless you're a new customer. If you're an existing customer, they just assume you know how to do that, and there is a different number to talk to, and you talk to AI about it, and you go from there.
It's freaky.
You know? It is. So he had to download the app to order a phone. You can't go into the store, being an existing customer, and purchase a new phone. Now, if you were with Verizon, it'd be all over you. Transfer the number, this, that, because that's a sale. But the sale of a phone, I guess they don't make that much money on, and it's not, you know, the commission, and they want you to go through the app.
Yeah, when I did this with T-Mobile, I went to two stores. Finally, I just dumped them. I had the phones. I brought them back. They ended up giving me a credit, but it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. The guy's looking right at me. I said, buddy, there's nobody here. You're doing nothing else. You can't help me for 5 minutes? I don't know.
No, and I brought it up. I mean, I had the same problem when I sold my condo. I had to give back my, you know, router to Infinity. You go into Infinity, they don't want to help you. They just want to sell you something. And I'm like sitting there and like, well, what are you here for? I was like, well, I'm returning my equipment. Oh, okay, we'll get back to you. Four people ahead of me. Oh, no, we're here to switch our... Oh, I'm all over it.
It's really kind of nuts.
Yeah, it is. But that's how it works. I mean, because they say you could drop it off at the store or at their location, and the answer is no, they don't want you to do that. They want you to send it back to them. They'll send you the packaging, prepaid packaging to send the routing stuff back, but the people at the store do not want to deal with it. They don't want to check the equipment. They don't want to do anything like that. They just want to sell you something.
Well, I would hope
new
that,
service.
I would hope that when people listen to the show, Mr. Flanagan, you're on a lot, that you don't zero in on individual stuff that we're all saying, even though I think we're trying to speak the truth. Even though I don't know about Flanagan, sometimes he argues with me. I think the thing that you should sort of pick up on, which is really the main theme of the show, is this is all sort of connected. If people were really competitive, they wouldn't want you talking to somebody you can't understand. Because if you had any place else to go, right? I mean, but if you don't, what do they care?
I have a good story to tell about that, yeah. Tom. Just last week, I got a suspicious-looking email about my PayPal credit card having just been approved with a spending limit of $18,000. Normally, I can spot junk like that pretty fast because, there's punctuation errors, there's capitalization errors, there's grammatical errors up the wazoo. And maybe the graphics were persuasive, but not much else. But this one looked really good and had all the things I would expect to see if I were getting a credit card. The date the card would be delivered to me at my address, everything. So I thought, gee, I better call PayPal, which I don't even have a PayPal account that I know of anyway.
That you know of.
I got a rep in, and I dreaded doing this because it was like a 10-minute wait to get through to somebody. And when the call was answered, it was by somebody in the Philippines who was very nice and very helpful. Verified I do not have an account and that there's nothing linked to my email or telephone number or whatever. So she was very reassuring and said, but please forward that email to this email address so that we may analyze it for our own security purposes to see what kind of phishing jobs, our hackers are trying to get away with. And then at the end, she said, can I ask you two brief questions? And she said, was I able to help you today? I said, yes, thank you very much. And then the second one was, were you able to understand me? And I just kind of stopped and I said, well, for once, yeah. And she laughed. But, I thought, well, somebody's got at least one place I've talked to in the last how many years has actually decided that's something you could actually determine, maybe in the course of a phone call for your own quality assurances, that the people you are paying money to, wherever they are, can be understood. Otherwise, it's kind of a waste of everybody's time. So I thought that was a good sign. I just wish other places would take the same interest in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you wonder how you can sort of do business doing things this way, but they do. It's like brokerage firms. I mean, we still pick up the phone. I mean, nobody else does. And, if you want to talk to somebody, there's nobody to talk to. But you know what, Jen? It is so beautiful that way. If you can pull that off. I mean, I'm not going to say I don't like what I do because I really do, and I like my clients. Wouldn't it be easier to just have everybody do everything online? There's never a mistake. You never give a recommendation.
They can understand you. You're speaking the same language.
Yeah, it's a. I mean, if you use our IB platform, it's cheap. It's really good for people. I mean, they can monitor. I mean, it's by far, I think, the best, in my opinion, order entry system. It's designed for professionals. But then again, it takes a while to learn a little bit. But you can do spreads. You can do all kinds of stuff, and those kinds of things. And they don't want to talk to anybody. I mean, if you call in and you're on vacation, you can't get near a computer. They charge you $75 to put the order in. We don't. you know, nobody takes advantage of it either. So, you know, that's the nice thing. The you know, so I mean, it can work, but if you're in a position where you don't want to talk to anybody. Matter of fact, that was way back when it started, the electronic trading. I think it was in Las Vegas, and I'm talking to this group of people, and they go, I said, what do you guys think about this, you know, being able to put your own orders in electronically? Oh, man, it's great. I go, now, why do you say it's great? Because I don't have to talk to my broker. I said, well, that's, you know, that's interesting, but the real reason is your broker doesn't have to talk to you.
Right.
They looked at me like I had five heads. I'm like, don't you get it? I mean, it's not that you don't want to talk to him. He's supposed to have some knowledge. He doesn't want to talk to you. And everybody looked at me like, well, who is this guy? So then I go, well, you know, we have a firm where we still like pick up the phone and stuff and talk to people. And one guy raised his hand. He goes, well, are you as cheap as the online people? And I said, well, not exactly. No, why would we be? I said, we're not that much more expensive, but. And I said, by the way, what do you do? He goes, well, I'm a dentist. I said, okay. Now, if I come in there to get my teeth cleaned, like, you're not going to do it for free, right? Well, no, why would I? I said, well, why do you get to talk to my brother for free? Well, what do you mean? I said, if you want to talk to my brother who's been here for 20 years, that knows the business, he's been a floor member in both exchanges, why do you get to talk to him for free? Yet he's supposed to, you will never clean his teeth for free. He says, well, these other guys are free. Well, then, yeah, they're free because you don't get to talk to them. If there was a machine that cleaned my teeth, maybe that would be free too. But there isn't. You know, but people have really odd views of the world, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, even to call these places is not free. I mean, if you get involved with you know, a health professional, depending on what level, the mere fact that you call them and you may wait on the line a long time to talk to them, that's a charge. You know, just for the privilege of asking a question to and getting an answer. I know I have known of doctors who try to put that on a bill as if it's a consultation of some kind. You know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's you know, it's,
I mean, lawyers did it. But, you know, when I was in a law firm, I had to log every 15 minutes of my life to some client or other, or wasn't going to get paid, you know, at the end of 2 weeks. So every phone call, you know, the duration of the call, the subject matter, all that stuff was, you know, going into the churning machine to produce a charge to some client somewhere. So, you know, I kind of got worn out on that pretty fast.
Well, yeah, I mean, you wonder how this is all going to play out, John, because it's been so long ago that when I took my it was a whole semester at Notre Dame, it was with Coach Leahy, it was labor economics. Everything you see now has kind of nothing to do with any sort of labor economics, because labor economics all kind of zeroed in on kind of one spot. I mean, I don't know if they knew they were doing it, but I mean, you didn't nowhere in the course. You know, the basic tenets of it are just like currencies. It's very similar. Currency. I hope people listen to the show somehow get to the idea that a currency is a good like anything else. A dollar is just a good. I mean, it's just another asset. Okay, and if you flood the world with them, they become less valuable, just like they are now, which means other prices are going up. It doesn't mean the other stuff is becoming more valuable. It's becoming more valuable in relation to the dollar, but not necessarily to other stuff. So that you got to be real careful with that. But labor is sort of the same way. I mean, if you look at what should somebody get paid, right? Now, if you start from day one, and you've got a system, you've got a product. God, you got to make the damn thing, right? Or do something to it. So all of a sudden you get somebody in and he starts making, you know, widgets and he helps you out. Now he's going to get paid some. Now you got power you got to pay for. You got to pay for the raw materials. You got to pay for the machines. It's a manufacturing operation. It doesn't have to be manufacturing. And you end up paying people. The competitive wage for that factory ought to be the last person in. Whatever he's actually good for the place, because I mean, the first, the first person in, if he's going to make 10 widgets in an hour, and you're selling the widgets for $100 a throw, well, you're not going to pay the guy $1,000, but you keep hiring people until the last person, everything equals out, until the last person is giving you the $50 an hour he's getting paid. That's how much he's worth it to you. His marginal value is the same as what he's getting paid. The last person is what. But now the problem is, what if all of a sudden you can take the widget manufacturing and put it on Mars, where they got a bunch of people there. They're somehow or another, they got a bunch of people there and are willing to work for a hell of a lot less. Well, that now that maybe not
will, they'll work for nothing at all.
Or maybe not willing to.
Right.
But you know, that's why I always talk about the thing, because I actually was privy to one of these episodes. I mean, I wasn't other than an introduction and heard kind of how it went. It was nothing to do with me or PTI or anything. But I introduced somebody from an Economic Club of Chicago dinner. It was the weirdest thing. Dan, I was sitting there and I get there early, and of course, these little cocktail tables, you know, you ever been in a room like that where they have a few little tables for people to stand? Not enough for everybody, because you're only supposed to be there a half hour, right? But right. If you grab one of those tables early, somebody's going to come and talk to you, because there's not enough tables, right? So this lady comes up, she's talking to me, and she turns out she worked for the Chinese embassy. And I said, gee, you know, what if somebody wanted to go over to China? Because we had just had somebody on the show who was in, don't call it Teflon, he was in coatings for pots and pans. And they were from West Chicago or someplace way the hell out there. And he saying, yeah, we haven't had to put a Chinese group out, and he was a guest on the show. We had to put a place over in China because all the people that made the pots and pans moved to China. So there's no way I can have a coating manufacturer in West Chicago when the pots and pans are getting made in China. He goes, I hated moving over there. He goes, but you'll go over there and they got a guy, and you know, you get in charge with somebody who's with the government, and he's kind of your consultant slash whatever. And they find you a place near where the pots and pans are being made, and all of a sudden you're paying this guy to do all this work for you, and the people aren't making very much, and you know, the guy makes sure that there's never a labor problem, and with the amount of money, but you had to add, you know, what you paid him to the hourly price you're paying the people, right? So essentially, there was a VIG on top of it. So I mean, that sort of is not counted. And plus, it goes against, you know, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Law, doesn't it? but nobody cares about that. So, but then all of a sudden, you're forced to go over there. He goes, how the hell can I make, you know, coatings to go on pots and pans when the pots and pans are being made in China? So one thing kind of leads to another, becomes, you know, a waterfall to a place. You know, so you really can't blame that on West Chicago, can you?
No. There's no substitute. They're not going to be able to go out and find somebody who needs their product or their skill, you know, easily enough to just start making it for somebody else. You go where the business is, or you go out of business.
No, but now, at the end of the day, you've got the idea was that the people in China, the lower end of the people, will start to make more and more, and they become your customers. Well, that hasn't necessarily happened. Yet there's essentially how many gazillion people in China have $1 million, you know, from, because they're part of the government group, and half of those guys are escaping and moving to Canada, and they were moving here, and for our current administration, I don't know if they're still doing it, but if you showed up with enough money, how many citizenships did that get you, John? If you came here with enough money to have a project where it hired 100 people, like if you were putting up a high rise or something, did that get you how many citizenships?
Oh, it's like getting annulments in the Catholic Church. If you get the prices right, you get all you want.
Yeah. And, you know, so it's not like this hasn't been complicit back and forth enough to where if somebody says, oh, no, that's the problem, the whole thing's a problem. The whole thing's a mess. Right? I mean, in Mexico, down there, which is closer, and I was, you know, Milton Friedman, those guys were talking about it. It's a good thing because, by the way, if we send a Chevy manufacturer down to Mexico, they're going to end up making as, you know, over a period of time, they're going to get higher wages, just like people did here. And, oh, by the way, they're going to become customers, isn't that what you want? But it sort of never happened. Now, who rides herd on the people down there? Is it the gangs? Is it somebody? I mean, nobody cares about how much the chairman of General Motors makes. I mean, everybody worries about, I mean, the thing about Kroger. I mean, do you think the food store manufacturers in Japan and China or India, you think the guys who run the food stores make as much as these guys? Nobody ever says, everybody's anxious to say, well, I can find an IT person that works for 10 grand less over in India or China. Nobody ever says, well, gee, I can find a CEO over there that works for less than you. That would be like a stink bomb in a boardroom, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you don't want that word to get out.
What do you make? What's the feel on? Should have Dr. Johnson calling in a little bit because
he's on. I can see you, Mark. How are you doing,
Dr. Blade? How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just enjoying this conversation.
Well, we're trying to. The last couple of weeks, Mark, we always seem to get on a. Whenever I get on a topic, and you start researching it, and the lovely people are on the show with me, we start talking about it. All of a sudden, I'm just scratching the surface. Then I just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper, and it finally becomes at a point, why did I even start this type of thing?
Sounds like my job.
So, yeah, I mean, it, you know, no matter what you do, it seems like last week, when the socialist group is running for the Democratic stuff, I thought maybe we should actually get the definitions of socialism and communism and capitalism and what exactly we have now, and would this be considered capitalism? Because my thought was, anybody who doesn't like the current system immediately becomes a socialist, and then they're dumb enough to call themselves a socialist, when in fact, they aren't even close to being a socialist. They don't want to give up their business or their house to the government, yet they're going to call themselves that. So it's kind of weird. I mean, it always starts with what do we have today? I mean, this isn't Larissa, who's our guest from Purdue. She's an economic professor there. I said, Larissa, what percentage of the money you spend, she has two kids, is in people that are what you would consider to be capitalistic or competitive? And she goes, well, way less than half. When you take the electric company, the phone company, the gas company, everybody else who's essentially a monopolist, and you take that out of the mix, there's not much competitive here. So we can't even define our own situation. But I'm going to ask you that. Go ahead.
No, it's a good question. I mean, I want to bring you out here to Vermont. There's a guy who's got a big billboard in front of his house that I have to go by when I go to the transfer station. It says, socialism destroys freedom. And I keep wanting to knock on his door.
I know. I don't. Where does crony capitalism and plutocracy land?
I know. Oh, yeah. Or kleptocracy.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Anyway, the definitions, we all kind of get glazed on. I mean, you can read and read and read. And I agree with you that the complexity gets pretty overwhelming. And the overlap is, I mean, I'm a systems guy, Tom. The work I do is really systems generated. And systems interact, and they overlap. And so those definitions become not so clear.
Well, the story, I'll be brief with this, because I don't know if you guys ever read Arm & Hammer by Arm & Hammer.
No, I did not.
Well, I didn't read the last third because I really didn't give a crap about Occidental, right? but the first two-thirds is an amazing period piece of essentially growing up in New York in the Garment District and during the Depression. His dad was a doctor, Dr. Hammer Sr., and he went to a couple of these communist, and there were fascist stuff that was going on in what they call it here. They call it the Bund, John. It was the Bund.
But
they had a big thing in Madison Square Garden. And anyway, so his dad went to a couple of these communist things because he looked at the Depression and said, "Well, whatever we're doing here ain't so hot. Maybe we should at least look at another system." Well, he ended up trumping up some abortion charges on the guy because he went to you delivered babies at home. And evidently, something was wrong with the baby, and he did anyway, accused him of doing an abortion. He's in jail, mainly because of his political views, and not really because he did anything wrong. So, I mean, this isn't sort of new. I mean, there were a lot of people here looking at alternative means. I don't think we're anywhere near as bad today as we were in the Depression, but a lot of people, and this is where we have Dr. Mark on. A lot of people now feel that this generation is the first generation that's not going to move forward, and it's. I think it's tough on the ego. That's why we have you here.
I agree with you for a lot of reasons, Tom. I mean, from my boots on the ground in mental health for 50 years. Folks in my field have been saying this for about 40 years anyway, that this intersection broadly with stress, which is, you know, a huge topic in mental health, and economics. And there's, you know, there's always some essential tension there if you want to make a living and feed yourself in any civilization or culture. But we've got a particular time and place now where our current young generation looks very much disadvantaged relative to where we were. Now, there's advantages. There's things they've got that we never saw. I mean, the kind of information technology and skill sets and some, you know, the ability to acquire wealth early in some ways. I mean, there's some of that stuff's really dramatically different. But overall, it's a tough ride. And, you know, what you're seeing, you know, that when you have, I mean, the usual is, I'll give you the long, but I'll give you the short stress lecture. The issue isn't intensity, it's chronicity. It's how long does it last, not how intense. I mean, people ride out hard stuff. I mean, this, you know, Chekhov's line about any idiot can face a crisis. It's day-to-day living that wears us out. I mean, it's that. It's the longer term of it. And when you're young, when you're 30-something, the long term can feel like 3 years, right? It's like, oh, my God, you know. Or 20 years, like, how long is it going to take me to be able to afford, you know, a house after I've paid off my school loans, after I've, you know, sort of mortgaged my business, whatever. I mean, it takes, so the stressors for that group, that now you get into round up the usual suspects, anxiety, depression, substance abuse, a high risk taking, those kinds of things just go flow from that very dramatically. And we're seeing even suicidality go up. I mean, it's, you know, it's a tough time to be in that age group. And you guys know, this is your expertise. I mean, the economics of this is really compelling to me. I mean, I'm not the economist, but when you see the converging forces in this, I mean, I'm consulting now in New York a fair amount, and young people, all 30s and 40-year-olds, and boy, we hear all about this.
What they're
living through.
I'm going to tell a quick story. I'll be brief because I told it last week. When I was, how old was I, Kat? It was 1991. Dr. J and I went over to Europe and did some lecturing. And we were at Creditanstalt. Talk about a great name, huh? Bank.
Right.
And then we were at Dresdner Bank in Germany. And I, you know, I'm teaching and John's teaching and everybody, all the option traders. All of a sudden, I get this weird feeling that they all work for somebody else. They all work for the bank. There was no entrepreneurial kind of thing. And then we go to have, you know, drinks, of course. And the guys are talking about, yeah, but even the lawyers, you don't get to be a partner until you're like 50. And there's no way that a young group of three guys, I think you probably still do that here, could form a law firm and like get anywhere in court because you weren't one of the real guys. And it was kind of a weird thing. Matter of fact, even with a stupid statement that I made, I see all these old dudes walking along with these young ladies. Well, they were old. They weren't as old as me now, but still.
That's never happened.
Yeah, and I go, well, but the ladies over there, Shay, are a little more forthcoming than maybe the women are here. And I said, boy, I like this festival. It's kind of a father-daughter thing. It's a family thing. And she goes, what do you mean? I go, look at these older guys with these younger girls. She looks me right in the eye, and she goes, German women like guys with money, and the old guys got the money. And I mean, nobody would ever say that here. You know,
that gets you shot from about four directions.
Oh yeah, but I'm the whole idea. The people that were at the time, they're 28, 29. They had like, when are you gonna? I don't know. I just work for the bank. When are you gonna family? Well, like maybe never. I mean, I'm still living with, you know, two other guys in an apartment. And when I left, I almost wanted to take a shower before I got on the plane. I'm like, I hope we never get like that. And at least here in the financial community, we're right there. Everybody works for somebody else now. There's no, nobody.
Well, let me ask you a question, Tom, because I just wonder about it from where you guys are sitting on this. One of the ways this manifests in my work is that there actually are gender differences in how this economic impact is affecting mental health. And I'm wondering if you see that.
I see. Boy, how can I say this? The women seem to be able to deal with it better. The guys, They're like not even guys. I mean, how's that? That's a really bad thing to say.
Now I'll quiz you, because I think you're right on track. So what would you say? Kind of, makes you say these guys aren't even guys?
Like, they're never. It's not like they, you know, it's not like they're not guys. But I'm saying there's no idea that they, that they're going to be able to provide for a family. Not that you should have but there's no.
But that just exactly echoes the psychological research, which is that men in this time, and you know, we all have this sort of general sense of maleness being partly at least attached to being a provider, taking care of your family, particularly taking care of them economically. And when you can't, or you can't even think of starting a family because you can't even take care of yourself, your sense of purpose, I mean, this ties into stress research that was actually done in Israel about war, you know, how war affects people as a trauma. And it's that people would lose their sense of coherence. It's like, what am I about? I mean, why am I even showing up? What am I doing here? And that's it gets pretty heavy. That becomes almost existential.
But I mean, it's not like you don't want your girlfriend, wife to. I think we're past that. I mean, it doesn't take away the fact that you're supposed to be the guy that, and when it's raining out, you're still supposed to take the garbage out. supposed to be the guy to whack the spider. But it's not that the girl can't do it; she can. But
that's true. Yeah, and when this has come up a lot, when you're the less well-heeled wage earner, there's an essential tension in that, like it or not. I mean, that's just how we're wired for this. I mean, I've seen couples, you know, any one of these generalizations, you can find a number of exceptions. Like, oh, I know somebody, the wife makes three times and everybody's happy.
Yeah.
But by and large, there's tension in that.
Well, there was a lady at Pullman, and she was the, what do you want to call it, the assistant to the plant manager. The hell was her name? Forget, but a spectacular lady. And it turns out that during the war, she was like a welder. And she couldn't have been 120 pounds on a bad day. And one day I said to her, I go, you know, how did that go? She goes, we all had a pitch in. She goes, at the end of the day, when the guys came back, that's a guy's job. I'm not designed to be picking stuff up that's 50 pounds and moving from spot to spot all day long. That's not me. That's what you guys are for. And it's not that women can't do it if they want to. And you know, but she goes, things are somewhat back to normal now. She goes, that wasn't normal.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not like I'm not disparaging anything at all. I mean, I'm just saying that somewhere along the line, guys have to feel like they can, like, do something. And I talk to people, when are you going to start a family? Well, never. When are you going to...
It's coming up a lot.
Yeah, when are you going to... They're never going to afford a new car. They're never going to be able to get a new house. And, oh, by the way, they're never going to have a family. It's like, well, okay, well... Do you play ball? No, I don't do that either. It's like, okay, well, what do you do?
That's what we're seeing, and we're starting these groups that are working, you know, in a group format. And we're not even calling it therapy. We're looking at it as training and relating. And that's what keeps coming up, is that these people they get isolated. Men particularly, this is a sort of a gender difference. Men under this kind of stress tend to withdraw. They tend to isolate. And with social media and blah, 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 the way the world is now, I mean, they're just the outlets for connection are getting fewer. And so that's a real challenge. Women tend to do better kind of socialization in that regard. They tap social support better than men do.
They seem fine. Yep. They're not fine, but I mean, I'm sure it's affecting them too, but they don't seem to be, they're still on their... They seem better wired for this.
Yeah, I think you're right. No, I would absolutely agree. And it's dangerous for men. Now, that's the flip side. It's not an easy time in this space. I mean, you'll get spectacular exceptions, you know, the billionaire in their 20s, whatever, but those are wild exceptions.
Well, one of the weird stories, not only John Tucker, they're always trying to, he has a million questions, but when the thing hit in 2007, right, we had just... you know, I was, you know, John and I were doing this stuff for the Scores. When first we met Mandy Weber and all these guys, and they all get laid off, right? And so I go, Mandy, you know, I don't really want to do this, but for you guys, I would. I said, you know, I used to remodel and paint houses. I said, you know, if you guys want to get together, I can get us a few jobs. I'll teach you idiots how to paint, and let's do a job every weekend. At least somebody's got, there's people dying for people to do stuff. Oh, we don't want to do anything like that. What do you mean? What do you mean? You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not too proud. I'm not too proud. What's the matter with you guys? Oh, we don't know anything like that.
I need some economic types to answer that question, because we see this here in Little Vermont. You know, people panhandling you on the street, and behind them are signs "Help Wanted." It's like,
yeah,
it just doesn't add, right?
No, the guy who works out in front of the 7-Eleven here, he's there more than the people inside.
He's probably making more money too.
Maybe, John, you had a question. Fire away, bud.
Yeah, Mark, you know, the impression I have is that if you're a guy, say in your 30s, and you went to college, or you got some, you know, foot in the door somewhere, but it hasn't panned out, downsized, or your job has been outsourced, and you're not married or whatever, you're really at a very tough, you know, turning point that can go, you know, a couple of bad ways. And I've seen so many people who are, you know, they are submitted to pharmaceutical treatments for depression or anxiety or whatever, and they end up being enslaved to that, and they're never, I mean, then they go into opioids, substance abuse, and overdoses, everything else by the time they're 40 or sooner. And this is meant to help them cope with a tough situation, but it's really putting them farther and farther behind the curve.
Well, you're singing my song. I mean, I had plenty of training in both sides of that fence. There's a place for psychopharmacology, I get it. But I mean, the largest prescription drug class used in this country are things like benzodiazepines, Valium family derivative drugs. And they are wicked hard to come off. And they're mostly prescribed by family doctors, right? So people go, these people aren't seeing mental health professionals. They're typically seeing their family doc, and they're saying, I'm anxious, I can't sleep, blah, 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 blah. And then they end up on a benzo, which can, just what you said, is very common. It can morph into, you know, painkillers, and it can certainly be associated with antidepressant drugs. And don't get me started, there's a long checkered history with that whole drug class. I mean, it's problematic.
So instead of playing softball, you go out and take a drug.
Well, you know, there's all kinds of evidence that good exercise and good socialization will lead you to as good, if not better, outcome than those drug classes, with exceptions. There's people who have like panic attacks. There's certain things that, you know, those drugs are really helpful. I'm not saying you can't, you know, there's no place for them. But as a standard dose to help you sleep, for example, that's a classic for this. You end up hooked on the drug, and then you don't sleep as well. Now your mood goes down. Now your energy goes. I mean, the whole, it's a cascade. Just what you said. I mean, it's right. That's where it goes. And so getting people to stop that train is really difficult. And there's a lot of data that withdrawal from those drugs really needs to be managed well. I mean, it's not an easy thing to just stop.
Well, who does? Who has a doctor that is close enough to them to do all this stuff?
You know, most people don't, Tom. I mean, that's, yeah, you know, another whole lecture about coordination of care. When we, you know, when I was in training, it's, you know, back in the dark ages, docs who prescribed for the same patient typically would talk to each other. I mean, how quaint. That just almost never happens, right? Because it's like there's fiefdoms and silos, and, you know, the family doc, general practitioner does his thing, and the psychiatrist does his, and the anesthesiologist does it, blah, 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 right? They don't have time, frankly. If you play it from the doc side, these people can hardly get their charts filled out and go home and go to bed.
Well, I know people, just naming the place, I know some good friends that have been, and some to not a good event, have been in Northwestern for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 days, and they come out, and I go, well, do you have a doctor? They all would say they're my doctor. Well, do you have a phone number? Well, not exactly.
Right, right, you know, right. Who's coordinating care?
We don't,
they'll be often now. The more common answer to that now is a nurse practitioner.
Well,
and that's not to knock them. They're well-trained. I mean, someone needs to fulfill that role.
But, you know, it's so bizarre. I mean, this is going to take maybe a minute here because we got too much better stuff to talk about. Audrey's poor poodle is having doggy ACL surgery today, right? And she's the sweetest pooch, 3 years old. She got hurt in the dog park. But anyway, so Audrey's got this vet who just happens, he's a chiropractor and he does other stuff for dogs. He happens to be a surgeon. He happens to be an orthopedic guy, and he's been doing this, you know, for a long time. So he's going to do the surgery. Well, then she asks all her other vet friends, she has a bunch, who's the best groups? Well, there's like two or three groups Well, they name the group. Well, a regular vet isn't going to do this kind of surgery, but they'll roll from vet to vet. If you have two or three dogs, they'll do it. And Audrey's like, well, is there a name of a doctor? Well, no, it's this group. Oh, so I don't really get a name. I don't get a name of a guy. Oh no, they just come by and they're the best. Well, who's they? it's so similar almost now to our medicine. I mean, it's not that far off. Do I have a guy that I can call if something goes wrong? Oh no, you call like the main number. I don't want to do that. I mean, it's crazy, but it's sort of where we're going, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's where they're now. I mean, having been privileged enough to be on the inside of that, at least around the Dartmouth system, I'm thinking as you're talking, Tom, that often the advice you want isn't who to call, it's who to not call.
Yeah. Well, what?
You have this problem. You don't want to go here. You want to go there.
Mark, when we're down this road, and we just, you know, I don't know if you were listening earlier, but we were talking about, Carl mentioned on Friday that the Kroger, now he mentioned they're in Cincinnati, evidently, and they are dumping. Chad, did he say their entire IT department and essentially contracted with a company in India to provide the same service for like a lot less dough? What happens like to those people? It's not like they found another job. There's now, you know, 3,000, 2,000, where the hell number is, 5,000 number of jobs like less here. So for those guys to all move together, those men and women. Plus, they all probably live in the same neighborhood. How many houses are going to be up for sale? Like half of them? I mean, when Robin was, she moved out to New Jersey, where Lucent was, dear departed Lucent.
I used to have Lucent stock.
Yeah, well, it was the most widely held stock there was. And she goes, all of a sudden, Lucent, I don't know, they went out of business, they moved. She goes, her kid Max went to class, and the classroom's half full. And every other house got a for sale sign on. So what does that do to somebody? We're not talking about
it's devastating. Yeah. I mean, we get, you know, this group we're seeing as different groups in New York, but there's a couple of them, high-flying guys in AI, IT, those, you know, just informatics, blah, blah, blah. Guys with, you know, fairly sizable incomes, and they, you know, they're doing fine on Friday and Monday, they're pink slipped, right? Boom. Yeah. And they're out. And now they're putting out 70 applications a day and getting no response.
Right.
Well, like none.
Well, not to mention, it seems like, I mean, we have normally on Monday, we have Nancy Rudd. And Nancy will say virtually none of the mortgages that she gives out to people can be, if both people are working, which is how you
right?
get enough. Because not one of them can be handled by one of the people. You probably can be handled by one of the people as long as you're on unemployment, but as soon as you pop off that, there's no way that the one person can handle the mortgage. So everywhere you look, this kind of piles up. I don't know what the word you used on that market. What did you say? It's the daily thing. If it keeps just a little bit every day, it gets worse and worse.
Well, this is where I wish I had more of your background. I mean, I don't know what, you know, what's the best advice for these folks? I mean, I know the stress advice, you know, which is, you know, stay open, adaptive, flexible, grit pays off, resilience pays off. But, it, you know, that becomes like a slogan when you've been one of my guys I've trained with, who's a good friend, he was unemployed for 14 months. He'd been running like the Boston Children's Hospital OD department, and boom, they downsize. And he's 14 months later he finally finds a job in Dallas. And he takes it, and he has no interest in moving from Boston to Texas, but that's where he is.
Well,
I think he's the norm, not the exception.
We got to go break in a couple of minutes, but to answer your question a little bit, Mark, boy, if I was, I wouldn't want to be somebody's consultant. I'd probably send them to you, but if, say, somebody lost their job, and they live in the burbs, and, you know, whatever, your typical burb family, and you got the kids maybe in school where it's costing you, maybe not, if you're in the right burb, you don't have to pay the private tuition, but you've got, you know, you got your car payments. I would probably say that if you've saved up anything, you know, I mean, nobody's got enough for a rainy day, really, in today's world, but if you had anything, you know, would you borrow a little bit with the idea that this is going to be obviously you're going to cut back on, you know, the nights out and so forth, but you're going to try and keep things as normal as possible, thinking you're going to be able to get a job, and you're going to do the best you can. What you just said, by the way, I know two or three people looking for a job. They go, they can't even get, you know, with the AI stuff, they can't even get they can't even get anybody to answer the stuff. There's nobody to talk to. There's a, you just get you tossed or whatever. You don't even know who the hell's tossing you, whether it's AI or whether it's just somebody's way of not doing it. But because you really don't want to yank the kids out of school, dump the house and everything, and all of a sudden you get a job 2 months from now, then what did you just do? So there's some judgment in here somewhere, but the judgment is tough. I mean, you know, you know when you start running into 6 months, 7 months, then are you so stressed that you found you look like an asshole in your interview? I mean, that could be too, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really a thing. I mean, part of it's been tumbling in a way, Tom, from our age vantage point, because this was just nothing I ever saw growing up or into my 30s and 40s. I mean, any of us, I think, could have changed careers, jobs just by choice then and had all kinds of options readily available.
Well, we had some pretty good education behind us, so
that made a big, huge difference. But still, do you ever know anybody personally who was unemployed for a year?
When we were
that age,
no, you could do something,
right?
You could go remodel houses. You did something.
Yep.
I mean,
we had multiple jobs. That was another sort of. I mean, that's something I get sort of old man about. It's like, you know, if there's jobs out there and you're not paying your bills, why not take one of those jobs, even though you don't want it or don't like it? It's not where you want to be. And then you get a pushback about how that, I mean, sort of sets the stage for downward mobility.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't either, but you can't sell that to somebody who's been making, you know, three times what they're going to make if they take this other job.
We got to go, but part of the thing, I tell you what, if you want to get something done in a house right now, I mean, the prices are to the moon. A lot of it's because we've kicked a lot of people out of the country. But I mean, if you couldn't, I mean, maybe I'm not big on ladders these days.
Me neither.
Yeah, but if it was 30 years ago and somebody said, hey, come help me put in a deck for a weekend, it's worth $800 to you, I'm there. But now nobody will even do that. And that's what people are charging. I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, I'm building a deck right now, just a little one for a platform. But I couldn't, if I put an ad in the paper of $50 an hour, I couldn't get help.
No, it's crazy. I mean, it's really nuts. And when Audrey's cousin died suddenly, unfortunately, it was kind of a self-induced wound. He was supposed to go in for a surgery, and he canceled it, and then, of course, the thing blew up. But his house, you know, Audrey's a really good... They couldn't sell a place. And she's a really good stager, because he liked, you know, darker colors. Anyway, Audrey says, we got to lighten this place up, because Audrey knows how to do all this crap. So she has these painters come in, and they were... I think they were, like, 20 grand or something. But they showed up, they did the entire place in one day. They showed up with, like, 10 people. He said, 3 or 4 more ladies...
Hello.
Because they were there at 6, and they worked till like 8 at night. Unbelievable job. Now, every one of those people, they probably couldn't do that more than 2-3 days a week, but
no,
everybody made $1,500. And the guy made like 4, you know, whatever. The guy put the job and he bought the paint. And so it's not like you couldn't pile in on a crew like that to hold you to hang in there for a couple of months if you're laid up, and nobody wants to do that. Why? I actually find it very nice.
Me too.
We got to go to break. SP Futures down 3, NASDAQ Futures down 28. Mark, when you come back, you and John, we got to talk about what's going on in the world and how it's affecting the markets here. And
you signing off with me for today?
No.
Oh, I wasn't sure. Okay.
No, you're in. Actually,
I'm stuck.
The people recovering are the people normally here the last half hour because they're off with the doggy knee surgery.
I will hang up.
We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your bank's, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Here's the thing. If you can't spot the sucker in your first half hour at the table, then you are the sucker.
If you can't spot the guy who's going to dodge on the check when you sit down, you're going to end up paying it. Okay, is that what that guy just said?
Pretty much, yeah.
S&P Futures down 5. I'm Tom Howe. We got Matt Byrne on the board. We got Jimmy in studio. We got Dr. Mark Johnson and Mr. John Flanagan. He's attorney. Don't hold it against him on the line. S&P Futures down 4. NASDAQ Futures down 32. We've got the Dow down. Individual stocks, nothing crazy. We got Honeywell down $5. We've got Meta up 12 because it has been down. Apple's kind of, it's not doing as well as some of the rest of these. It's down 355, but they all seem to be having their day here one day or another. Micron's down 13, but it was up a bunch Friday. Up, down, up, down. We're going to talk to Dr. Mark about that in a minute. Nikkei's up 1,300. That's 2%. We've got Hang Seng up 269, 1%. Shanghai up 26.7. So over in Asia, people are kind of liking this. I think this is still kind of a hangover from that big move the U.S. made in the Japanese yen a week ago Friday, which still is mind-boggling to me. DAX up 70.2%, FTSE down 25.2%, CAC around up 9, call that flat. So Europe is not much of a hint here. Bonds unchanged at 4.66 at the 10-year rate. Japan, 2.81. That's the one we kind of got to watch. Oil up $1.17, $79.35, as nobody can figure out what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz. Oil prices rise amid uncertainty over U.S.-Iran Strait of Hormuz deal. It seems to me the deal right now is between Iran and Oman, and we're not even part of it, but who knows, maybe we are. RBOB up 6 cents to 304, which means you're probably paying somewhere high threes or low fours, depending on the tax in your state. We've got gold on $13, $43.85 after a huge week last week and a 7-week high. Silver up 51 cents to $64.01, foreign exchange. What we want to look at here is the Japan is up again here, $158.79. So we're up for this number means down on the value of the yen. Got down to 157 after the intervention. It's already creeping back up toward that 160 number. That's not what we want to see. Bitcoin down 254, 64,894. A lot of stuff. Matt, what do you got for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
Yeah, good morning, everyone. It's currently 7:38 a.m. on August 10th, 2026. Weather for Chicago today, 74 degrees, overcast skies, chance of thunderstorms in the area later today with a high of 83. Tonight, low of 70, and a chance of storms continue. Sports, of course, we got yesterday for the Chicago's MLB teams. Cubs won against Kansas City Royals. White Sox won against Guardians, 5-3. White Sox are 61-56 losses this season. Cubs are 69-50 this season. Cubs are back on Tuesday with Nationals, and Sox are back on the same day with Reds. We look towards the NFL preseason that starts on Thursday. We'll see Lions, Bengals, Packers, Steelers, Colts, and Patriots, and we'll see the Bears start their first preseason game on Saturday. So I got Chief, back to you.
Just as a real quick aside on the baseball, I know I watched a little bit of the Padres last night, and the Cubs just came off. The crazy weather we had in the spring, Jimmy, you've got the Sox tickets, but or the Cubs tickets. Cubs tickets, sorry. All those early rainouts, some teams, did San Diego's got to play 19 days in a row with the makeups? And the Cubs were, what, 17 in a row?
Yikes.
I mean, it's these makeup games, it's kind of crazy. But, Mark, I want to kind of shift gears a little bit. And, Jan, you know, bring me back to the reservation here if we need to be. In terms of economics and money, when you start seeing the amount of wealth flying up and down in one label, and Larissa's always talking about this K-shaped recovery, although Scott Bessent said last week that that's over now, everybody's doing good. I don't know where the hell he got that, but she was even saying that the lower part of the top K group was starting to fall off. What do you do when you see a whole bunch of people cutting coupons and you see a stock going up with 25 billion shares outstanding, goes up 10 bucks, and it's a quick $250 billion made in like one day? And it seems like some people are you know, bobbing for nickels, and other people, they don't even, the $100 bill isn't worth lighting their cigar with it. I've never seen this kind of a separation where we're talking, how many people even know what $1 trillion is? And I sure as hell don't. I mean, what do you make of this, Mark? I mean, people
it's
are.
It's 1,000 billion. That's what I know.
Well, there you go. And I mean, John and I talk about this a lot. I mean, what do you even? On one hand, the amount of money is dramatic into the system, and other people aren't getting any part of it. It's, I've never seen anything quite like this. I mean, I never.
You know,
heard.
It just feels like there's, you know, an essential tension in that. You can call it wealth inequity, whatever, you know, income distribution stuff. And it is kind of mind-boggling. I don't think, you know, those kind of numbers, it's hard to get your head around. It's hard for me to get my head around. I mean, $1 billion, holy moly, I mean, what the hell? $1 million still seems like a lot to me.
Not anymore. We got somebody.
Well, there's too many, yeah. I know, there's a gazillion millionaires now.
Well, I mean, we have to do the thing on the show. If I had $1 million, I got to get one of our guys to AI that and say if I had $1 billion, because $1 million is chump change now.
Well, when we were kids, there was a TV show called The Millionaire. You remember that?
Yeah, yeah. When we were kids.
This was like way back.
They had TVs then?
Yeah, I know. Black and white.
Black and white. But it's just kind of amazing the difference in... And you know, it's kind of weird to me, and I don't know psychologically, and John, I'm talking too much, pile on here, but it seems like the money, and, you know, I have a whole bunch of clients that are in this boat. By the way, it's a good boat. If they invested stuff in their 401ks, they did the right thing, and they got the mix, and the stocks have gone up. And the dollar's not worth as much, but by and large, nominally. But the people who seem to have the $10 million now are the people who, I guess, were smart enough. I mean, Apple stock has been a big change because it actually got down to like $7 or $8, and people liked their product and actually bought at a price where... it's been a life changer for a lot of people. Yep. But the thing of it is, Mark, in our era, you made, your wealth was built by essentially earning it. I don't see anybody now, not anybody, you know, with 200 grand a year in expenses making 300 and putting 100 in a bank. I mean, it seems like that's right. Not what anybody, the wealth is in, I mean, Audrey, does a lot of house stuff, and she's usually here on a Monday, where most of her stuff now is cash deals. It's people who bought a house when they were 35 at, you know, 120 grand, and now they sell it for 500, and they go buy a condo because they don't want the house anymore, they don't want the steps or whatever because they're getting older, and they pay cash for it. I mean, it's this level of money that's around, and the money is either in stocks or in people's house that grew up. I mean the people, they don't, they never made enough in their entire lifetime to have saved $500,000 to pay cash for a house. It just seems like a different world, and I don't know if it's psychology. I mean, what happens if this all changes? I mean, what if the market goes down 40% or something, for God's sake? I mean, God help us if it does, and all of a sudden these houses that are worth $500,000 are back down to 300. What does that do?
There's a lot of economic uncertainty. I mean, one of the things that would, you know, just from the psych side alone, Tom, because I have no answer for the economics. It's out of my bandwidth. But we know that economic turmoil, this kind of economic distress broadly, is compounded by relational distress. And that's you know, just sort of a clinical truism that your home life's not going to be great when your economic life's not great. So the future side of this, like, you know, why did we, you know, what was the message just when we were kids about going to school? Well, you can, you know, improve yourself. You can improve your station in life. You can change economic class. That's the start of this piece when we started today. That's, to me, was the start, and I think that's going to be the finish, which is, how do you imagine a downward trend for economic class, whether it's, you know, the edge of the upper class to the bottom of the middle class, whatever drop you want to call it. There's a lot of that going on, and some of it's wealth transfer stuff, which you know more about than I do. But there's been a lot of concentration of wealth in our generation, and where's it going to go? But the remark you made about earning it, I think that's a really tough one, because what I've seen in the young people we've been working with, they work their asses off.
Oh, yeah.
These people aren't lazy. They're not. They're trying really hard. They're working. They're doing their 100-hour weeks. They're killing it, and they're not getting anywhere.
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah.
John Pyle.
You'd expect that for, you know, the guys who work in, you know, investment banking, and they start their Goldman Sachs first year in their 100-hour weeks. Now it's like everybody and his brother.
Well, whenever anybody lays somebody off, which you're really doing is cutting the pay of everybody else, right? Because I don't care who you are, you did something.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to be the guy that did absolutely nothing at his job. you do, even if you unlock the door in the morning, you did something. I mean, when these people say, "Well, we laid off 40,000 people," I mean, wait a minute, all 40,000 of them didn't do anything.
why were they hired?
Something, you know, when you're saying that, you know, parents would tell kids, you know, education will give you mobility, class, you know, shifting, whatever. Do you detect, because I think I sometimes detect that the people who have college educations now, who paid a huge price for them compared to what we had to pay,
yeah,
have a sense of entitlement about their position in the world, that they think the education has already granted them. This is something they feel they have to work further in order to certify. And as a result, they don't want to take jobs that they think are beneath them, because they went to college just so they would never have to work a job like the one I may have to work to make ends meet.
I think it's a good point. I think there's also, what I get from them is bitterness and resentment. I mean, you know, the clinical side of this is you'd think as soon as you hear the word entitlement, you start to think narcissism. Yeah. And narcissists think they deserve more than they earn, and that they're worth more than they're paid. And it's just classic. I mean, and they think they make a greater contribution to the group effort than anyone else around them would say, and they still feel underpaid. That's the hardcore version. Being that the soft one is that, you know, these kids got, you know, these 30-somethings got sort of sold the same bill of goods that we did, which is, yeah, go to college, you'll have that set career, you can be, quote, set for life in the best case scenario. And that is just way not happening. We've seen changes in what kids will study, right? I mean, all kinds of colleges are dropping liberal arts majors because they don't translate into money. And that, you know, it's the opposite of when Tom and I were in school. I mean, it was fine to be whatever kind of major you wanted. It didn't mean, yeah, you might want to go to business so you'll major in econ like he did, but you could have taken courses in all kinds of things. You were there to broaden your horizons. There's a phrase from the 70s. And now you're there, college has turned into a trade school, and it's not paying off, right? Not like people expected. Even for people, I just had a train ride. I was sitting next to this woman who's going, a high-level IT type, going from Boston to D.C., and she was talking about this exact thing, and she's saying, you know, I switched into computer science when I was a junior because everyone said, you'll never be without a job, and I'm looking for one right now, right? I mean, that's what's happened to those people. I mean, there's certain jobs that seem to be kind of bulletproof. Engineering in many places can get you where you want to go, if you go to medicine and law, but even that's sketchy now. There's a lot of people, I mean, I've worked closely with people who are seriously considering not doing medicine because it doesn't pay off economically. They end up with, you know, $500,000 in debt, and unless you pick a super paying specialty, you're never out of debt until you're 50 years old.
Well, I think a lot of it, and this goes back to my economic, and Mark, you've known me too long. My instinct is to put numbers on anything. But when we were in school in those days, when the vagaries of the blue collar world were, you know, it started with the first oil embargo. Places closed, and the idea that you could work as a welder your whole life and all of a sudden at age 50 the place moves and you got no place to weld. I mean nobody wanted that, you know. So everybody, our parents all said, no, you got to go do something where you at least broaden your knowledge a little bit. It didn't mean that you had to take accounting or you had to take engineering, but the price at which you went, I mean, for us, I mean, I'm going to say when we were seniors, our tuition was $3,000. You could easily have gone to a really good school like University of Illinois for probably $1,500,
yep.
And you could have gone to Western, which is almost as good, for $1,000. So yep. for you not to do that between ages, you know, 18 and 21, you know, and just, you know, sit at home and play tiddlywinks was crazy. You got to learn how to deal with people, you got to meet people, and you learned a bunch. Whether some of it was useful later in life or not, it was a bunch. So to not do that was, I think, really foolish on somebody's part. Even if it was a junior college, take some courses. Even if you're working every day, take accounting at night, do something. But now, you know, I went to the University of Chicago. One class now is appreciably more than my entire education there. Now all of a sudden, if it doesn't get you to $200,000 a year job, you're screwed, and it's a whole different world. Education right. is not the bad guy here; it's the price, I think.
Right. Well, and they said the price differential relative to cost of living and inflation, yeah. which I'm sure you could describe better than I can. But those graphs look very separated.
Well, they sure do. And matter of fact, I did a too long of a story here today, but I went back and did some stuff on CPI between, I did it a few years ago, 2020 and say 2020. CPI is up like, you know, supposedly like went up 0.8%. So it's up 80%. I found college education, medical care, and primary education was up almost 300%. Not even close.
Wow.
Now, granted, you could say that, you know, the cost of cell phones went down and a few other things went down, but by and large, they've totally outstripped. And if you were to put our senior year in the CPI indicator, mm-hmm. Notre Dame education should be 20, and it's 80.
Yes.
Yeah. We're not even close. Well, it's probably 70 plus 10 for... What about room and board? We played 1,000. Now what is it, 12?
I can remember when we graduated thinking if I could make 20K a year, I'd be in Fat City.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was big money, Mark.
You were here.
It was.
Well, 20 grand a year was, the little afterward, the number that put, it essentially made the middle class is when the auto industry started paying 20 bucks an hour, because that's 40 grand a year. I mean, it's 2,000 hours in a year, for those that don't know. 2,080 to be exact. Because nobody gets to work that anymore. Even that little stuff, Mark. If I show my age or somebody, I go, well, how are you doing? Oh, I'm making $15 an hour, and I go, okay, well, that's 30 grand. No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean that you're working 40 hours a week. People have sure. no problem working you six or seven, and oh, by the way, the parking's 15, well, and you're only working 6 hours.
In prep for this showtime, I was doing a little homework about, you know, cost of living stuff and the impact on people. And this little factoid showed up to the extent you can trust any AI platform. And it basically said that there's only two states in the United States where you can have a minimum wage job and afford rent with just that job.
What would those states? It's got to be
West Virginia.
I was going to say maybe Mississippi close or someplace like that.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, this, like, so with the rest of us, you need two jobs just to pay your rent.
Remember the old, actually, this started when Clinton was in office. They got him back when they used to do, does anybody do caricatures anymore? The little, you know, the comics. Well, this one was the guy. The character was Clinton was mouthing off about how many thousand jobs he created while he was in office, and the guy putting the rubber chicken down in front of him has a little note that says, "Yeah, and I got three of them." But you know, you remember when as soon as somebody got a job, no matter what it was enough mm-hmm. to, even if you got a job, you know, my uncle was a policeman. And he was undercover for this county, and they took down a couple of really bad gangster guys and stuff. Anyway, Ogilvy comes in and he fires all the Democrats. So my uncle was a tool and die maker. There was a recession going on. He ends up from the alderman. He gets a job as a bridge tender, which he hated because he only raised the thing like once at night. So you talk about it, you sit there for 8 hours and raise the thing once. But once he got a job, all of a sudden, it was enough for the rent. It was enough for some chow. It wasn't enough for, like, a new car or anything. But a job meant you could move along. But now, I'm thinking $15 with a 30-hour week isn't enough to take you anywhere, is it?
I don't think so. I mean, most of those folks end up with multiple jobs. They end up, that's the only way they can survive.
So what are you telling these guys in New York? What do you, I mean, people, everybody has to be afraid of...
Well, some of it is, I mean, we're, of course, landing more on the relational side than the economic side, but some of it is the, you know, the old school stuff about networking and just getting, you know, talking to people face-to-face, trying to actually get, you know, into the orbit of somebody who's going to make decisions about hiring and firing rather than just mass blanketing the universe with your resume. That's easier said than, I mean, it's, in some ways it is easier in New York because it's kind of a, you know, a dense environment for employers, but it's also a dense environment for employees. So it's tough. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, and the other thing is just New York, I mean, the cost of living is like nuts. I mean, the rents there, I mean, it's crazy. So they have to deal with that reality. Many of them have to deal with realities like they can't simply, with their skill set, the job they could get now, even if they got the job in New York, they couldn't afford to live there. So now what?
Yeah, right? It's a...
And they end up, there's a dispersal. A lot of these folks are leaving. And the whole, you know, the IT world, that whole, just, it's really having a convulsion, it feels like, at least from what we see there.
Well, we had
because they want to downsize. I mean, AI is part of this, right? Kevin claims AI to take my job.
Well, Kevin claims it's kind of an excuse that people hired too many people and now they're matter of fact, maybe. I read something. John, did you bring this up? Somebody, one of our guys that's on the show a lot sent me something about how 25% of all the companies that have laid people off due to AI don't even have AI. Huh. Or something along those lines.
That's great.
They're ahead of the trend.
They're ahead of the trend. I mean, what do you do if you land one of these people? I was going to say one of my buddies got laid off in our industry about a year ago. Thankfully, he'd been there long enough where he got like 50-week severance. But mm-hmm. Like you're saying, Mark, he sent out so many resumes. He even got somebody to. Part of this, the package was they sent him to Challenger Gray to teach him how to do resumes and stuff. And even then, he couldn't get anything. So finally, after about 40 weeks, somebody called him up and go, "Hey, we need a guy. Are you still around?" He goes, "Yeah, he was hired in like 2 weeks. It came from a buddy of his."
Wow.
I mean, it had nothing to do with the other stuff. I mean,
now, who you know seems to be even, you know, if anything, more important. But that. It's such a weird world. I mean, I feel de-skilled there, frankly, Tom. So, like, we knew what worked for us. But what's working for this group is different. And they have to stay. I mean, some of them have to just completely shift gears and just say, yeah, I'm going to, you know, whatever I thought I was going to do for a career isn't happening. I got to do something
what
else.
What do you do when the stress and the, you know, the long road ahead for a lot of people. I mean, we all know these people. It's not like, you know, we're talking about people that are from the moon. What do you do if you bump into them and, by the way, they cross paths with the people that are taking all these drugs you're talking about just to sleep at night? They can't make it easier.
Oh, no, it's worse. And, a lot of what we're trying to do is just get these folks to kind of get grounded in reality, like what's helping, what's not helping. And their short-term notion is these drugs are helping. Well, okay, let's take a look at that for real. And it's a hard sell because addiction is another whole animal, right? Because you're not reasoning with addicts. I mean, that just doesn't happen.
Mark, do you have any thoughts on where, you know, working at home has affected
good question.
Aspects? It could be a way of saving on stress, dealing with traffic and commuting and expenses, eating out and everything. But does it have a toll attached to it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's my son-in-law is this guy. He's an IT guy. Works for an educational software company from his house in Nowhere, Wisconsin. He's in Grand Marsh. If you know where that is, you get a prize. He's an introvert and he likes to. Doesn't want to be in the office setting. Twice a year, he's got to go to Washington. That's like his two worst weeks of the whole year. he kicks it at home. He's winning awards. He's doing great. So he's, for some people, it's just a ticket, right? But there's the whole social element of this, social support element, networking element, loneliness. I mean, this is something that's really showing up a lot, especially with unemployed men, that they're fundamentally, you can call it depression and anxiety, but when you dig at them and sort of ask them to describe their experience, what they tell you eventually is that they're lonely. They don't want to be, you know, especially if the wife's out working, they're home alone doing what, right? How many times you can do the dishes, right? And send out another slew of resumes that don't get you any answer. And there's a psychological cost to that. And it's taking it personally in the sense of feeling personally rejected or devalued. Easy to say, don't do that. You know, I've never had to apply. I mean, the closest thing was applying to graduate school and getting, you know, 10 rejections out of 13, which was standard.
Yeah.
You just don't get, you know, you're not getting in everywhere you apply. It doesn't matter how good you are. And that doesn't feel good.
University of Chicago, yeah. The word was flushed.
When I get into my graduate school, I asked the director of clinical training, how do you decide who to accept? They took 10 of us from 700 applicants. He said, we fill the applications up in the air, and the ones that don't come down, we accept. It's like, great. No idea.
We got a dash here, prison, but I think we need to continue this someday soon, Mark. You're too good of a guest to not be like every couple of years.
Happy for me. It's great to talk to you guys. Great questions, by the way.
Well, you know, I think people have to be zeroing in on stuff like this because, I mean, two things. When people work from home, I will say this. If nobody met you, it's a lot easier to fire you. You know,
yeah, that's true too.
But there are people that actually do seem to do very well doing that. That would drive me nuts. But
even with my brother-in-law, my son-in-law, he's kicking in doing all this stuff. He's constantly applying for jobs. Even he's got a great job, but he's always looking. He's always got feelers out for who. If there's a better landing spot, he wants to be ready to go there. He's a smart guy. He's figured it out.
All right, well, good for you. Hey, good having you, John. Thank you very much.
Mark, always a pleasure.
And, Jimmy, good job. Matt, as usual, good stuff. You know, maybe next Monday what we might do, you know, I don't know if you might have met him years ago, Mark, when you came to visit me on the floor. We had a guest, Doug Redmond, who came on as a guest one day, and he's an absolute character. We call him Coach because he was a coach at Purdue. He passed a couple of weeks ago, unfortunately.
Okay.
But we're going to dig and replay the interview. I gotta call you, Mark, when we play it because
jingle.
It's hilarious because when he was coach at Purdue, just to give you a quick one. Coach was one of these guys that if you were always on the edge, that if you weren't really almost cheating, you weren't really almost trying. But he coached the offensive line. He made the guys on the offensive line put on gloves the same color as the other guy's jersey. So after about 2 weeks of this, they go up to play Wisconsin. Of course, everybody's got these red gloves on, right? But after 2 weeks, the Big Ten comes out and goes, you can't do that, you idiot. But he got away with it for 2 weeks or something. Absolutely hilarious. But unfortunately, Coach is passing. We'll talk about it. He has a lot of stuff about the trading floor, too. But SP Futures down 4, NASDAQ Futures down 41. Not much of a move, considering how much we were up last week. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?